and welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me today, as per usual. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. I'm pleasure to be here. My name is Elise Prussing, and I am a midwife here in Port Macquarie, and I work full-time for the University of Newcastle as a midwifery academic.
So how long have you been in midwifery? What got you into midwifery in the first place?
So my midwifery journey started with the birth of my first daughter, Leela, who's now 10. 2 weeks after I had Leela, I applied to the Bachelor of Midwifery at Newcastle, Port Macquarie, and got accepted. I guess the whole birth process, I actually had never really thought about what midwives did or what their job entailed until I was in hospital, gave birth to Leela, and just the midwives were so compassionate and helpful, and they made me feel so special for having a baby, and they were just amazing, and I just thought I would love to do that and make other people feel like they made me feel. And I guess it was a bit of a shock that's how I felt after I had her, when the whole time I was pregnant, all I heard was these horrible stories about family's experiences and friends' experiences of having a baby and giving birth. And I wasn't prepared for how amazing I felt and how special it was to have a baby. So that's what drove my passion and why I applied to become a midwife.
That's a huge life change in 2 weeks.
Yeah. My mum's like, you should be a midwife. And I'm like, I was thinking the same thing. You just read my mind. And coincidentally, so I had her in October, and then January, February the next year, they were starting the degree here in Port Macquarie. So at the time I lived on the Gold Coast, we packed up our newborn baby and moved back home near my family, and I started uni. So
life change after life change after life change.
Yep. Jumped straight into this crazy rapid flowing river of midwifery. It's been my life for the last 10 years, really.
So what kind of models of care did you get into when you finished and graduated?
So Port Macquarie based hospital is the only maternity service here in Port Macquarie. There's no private obstetrics or anything like that. We've got 4 obstetric consultants that do like a week each, and yep, they change every 4 weeks. There's a new obstetrician on, and that's the only model here. So that's the model that I've worked in, and fell in love with continuity of care as a student, and offering that continuity relationship as a student midwife through that hospital-based maternity care system. Yeah.
So do they have a caseload model or primary?
No, not at this stage. We just employed a project officer. She started in August, and hopefully very soon implementing a model up here in Port.
Oh, fabulous, because Westmead have got the caseload model now too, and that seems to be going really well, and they're a busy unit. So how many births do you have at Port Macquarie?
I think it's roughly 750 births a year, approximately somewhere between there. It fluctuates a little bit, but normally sits around that. Yeah.
That's a nice steady demand at certain times of the year.
Yeah, yeah.
So what did you do a master's post-grad after that, or did you just spend some time enjoying the career?
So I finished 2015, and I went straight into an honours full-time with my new graduate position, just because the lecturers that I had at uni were really encouraging, and I thought, oh, I may as well while I'm in the habit of studying.
Yep.
And really wanted to help support change of practice and saw that research is a way that you can influence practice. So jumped at that opportunity. And after finishing my honours, was eligible to apply for a scholarship to do my PhD. So that's what influenced, I guess, where I am today and why I've chosen that pathway.
So what did you do your honours on?
I did my honours on, so up here, if you present with a breech baby in pregnancy, the options are external cephalic version or cesarean section.
Oh, wow, so no vagina.
No, and I had a continuity woman that I followed who had a breech baby on board in her second pregnancy, and they had a really strong faith and they wanted a large family, and she did not want to have a cesarean section, wasn't eligible for ECV, so decided in labour that she was going to travel to the breech clinic in John Hunter. So I get this message at 2 o'clock in the morning saying, I'm in labour and we're on our way to Newcastle. And I just felt like that was such a shame when we could have potentially prepared for her birth and offered her something completely different. So my honours thesis was looking at the number of women who transfer from Port Macquarie to John Hunter and their outcomes around that transfer and breech birth. And yeah.
So how many were there?
Well, I couldn't get access to the data, which was another issue.
Oh.
And I ended up writing up a protocol as my publication. So it didn't go to plan, which often research doesn't, but it was still an interesting topic to pick. And yeah, I still am passionate about that.
So without going into kind of ethical issues, what was the issue with not being able to get the data? Was it that wasn't being kept, nobody had it, or?
No, it was more around the cost of access to be able to look at the data at that point in time. It was thousands and thousands of dollars, which was out of my reach as an honours student. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So something for future grants that maybe add on
yes.
some kind of costing and include that into it so you still get there eventually. So what did your protocol then kind of end up recommending?
That we should be looking at ways to facilitate vaginal breech birth and training clinicians to feel comfortable and confident in those skills is what we need more research around that. Yeah.
So how did you go with some of the stuff that Sean Walker's written?
I haven't looked. So after my honours, I jumped into a PhD that looked at implementing midwifery continuity of care models, and I have not looked at
anything
since then. So
I highly recommend you check out Sean Walker's stuff because
I will.
She's UK. She did her PhD is in breech. She's the breech queen. You will love her stuff and what she's kind of putting through. So she'd be worth touching base with again. So why the separation then? Because the PhD, why not then an expansion on what you were doing? Was it because it was too difficult to get access to, or was that continuity also one of those other kind of like pick me issues that kind of was sitting there?
Yeah, so I went into my PhD thinking that I could use that as an opportunity to implement a model and wanted to do it as a pilot study and implement a model for my PhD.
Okay, so going straight up there.
Yeah.
Cool.
Quickly, that turned into something much more manageable for a full-time PhD student and was a qualitative study that explored the factors that influence implementing continuity models.
So
barriers and facilitators and focusing on regional areas.
So who were your participants then?
So my study was a constructivist grounded theory methodology and approach to the study. So initially, after doing that sort of initial scoping literature review, found that I needed to definitely interview midwifery managers and CMCs. And then also around that potentially looking at the perspective of midwives and women because it's going to impact them. But what happened was I jumped in and interviewed that initial participant group of managers and CMCs. And after data analysis and looking at it, because it happened simultaneously with constructivist grounded theory, I found that midwives were were the greatest barrier to implementing these models. And that really surprised me. I wasn't prepared for that to be coming out of the data, thinking that everyone was just like me and wanted to work in continuity models and were just frustrated that they couldn't. And then so I definitely then theoretical sampling led to interviewing midwives finding out why they were such a barrier and why they were so unsure of the models. And what I found was that because of the regional focus, that midwives in regional areas work very differently in different areas depending on where they work and who they work with and how the service is set up. So it was really interesting learning that midwives don't work their full scope of practice everywhere, and it's quite common for midwives to stay in one familiar area. Often in regional areas, there's that aging workforce and they're not as open to change because they're like, oh, I'm ready to retire. I don't really need to learn too much more. I'm not interested in upskilling because there's that hope that they're going to retire and enjoy the rest of their retirement rather than learning new skills and then not using them, I guess. So, and that has a really big impact on workplace culture and supporting newer, younger, earlier career midwives to feel confident that continuity is something that they would then work in when they're looking and being supported by an older generation of midwives who might not be as accepting of that change. So it was really interesting.
So did you find that there was some barriers that the managers thought existed, but when you talk to the midwives, it was actually the opposite, or it wasn't supported, or did they all kind of like, yep, they all kind of matched on in agreement?
I think that the managers introduced that they were so surprised that the midwives were such a barrier, and they touched on that there was this lack of confidence and lack of awareness about continuity models and what it is. Especially in that regional population of the workforce. But then exploring that further with the midwives themselves and learning that they quite often didn't know, they knew that continuity was beneficial, but described it more around the trust and familiarity with the women rather than thinking about the evidence side and the Cochrane review and that it can reduce preterm birth and neonatal death and interventions. And when being able to describe that is really important when you're trying to sell it to a health service and engage those executive level managers, which midwives, I think also they spoke about being able to engage those managers was really difficult, and trying to understand their role when those managers have very different priorities to a midwife working and understanding the importance of that relationship with women. So, there was an introduction to midwives being an issue, but then the midwives themselves, being able to explore that with them, I got so much more of an insight as to why they were a barrier and understanding what it was that was stopping them from feeling confident to transition to that model and to request it in the first place.
Was it a thought by those regional midwives that because they were within the communities that they already had a de facto continuity of care because they knew the women anyway?
I think in very small units, yes, but I still think that the midwives that I interviewed obviously we're passionate about continuity, so I didn't get so much of that flip side of that perspective where they definitely weren't supportive.
Yeah.
But in smaller units, definitely they did speak about having some sort of continuity and knowing some of the women but still not having that time and continuity that you would get with like a caseload setup, and not being able to provide that full scope of practice either, because another thing be skilled, because that obstetrician is always there for the birth and they're the ones that are accoutering rather than the midwives actually being midwives themselves and taking the lead at that point when it could have, they could have easily done it. Yeah.
Do those regional areas get many students?
I didn't ask that question, but the student thing came out quite strong in the interviews. It was one of the major concepts that did emerge, that students are vital for these models to upscale them and translate them, because they're our future workforce, but also quite strong in changing that workplace culture around supporting the model. They understand the evidence. They've experienced it as a student midwife to some degree, and they role model that to the workforce, how important it is to have that relationship. And they're so passionate about it. So students definitely came through as a strong theme.
Did you also think that when you've got, especially those really engaged students who kind of will sit there and actually have those really good debates and topic conversations, that they can bring some of that kind of like renewed vigour back into a practice that has had the same kind of like five people in it for the same 10 years, which is really good for them. But you also do get set in your ways. You do kind of, we've got into not complacency, but you get into your own rhythms.
And plus that workforce, they've probably tried in the past as well to implement it or make some sort of change towards a model, and it hasn't happened, and they get burnt by that. Mm. Was definitely a little bit of burnout from trying to implement models and it not succeeding. Yeah.
It's hard to be a midwife on the floor and looking at what you do day to day and then still translate that into return of service, return of investment, all of that kind of higher managerial language really, to try and make that change if you don't have the experience or the postgrad courses to kind of use it.
Yeah, and also understanding the higher level management and what their roles are and how to engage with them was really difficult for midwives on the floor. Yeah.
I think we're underestimated with a lot of the kind of postgrad studies that we do, is we can put ourselves too much in the silo too, that having general business model soft topics into postgrad topics I think could actually be quite an advantage, because it opens up, and I know a couple of midwives who've done MBAs and they've gone, best course I've ever done, because I now know how to talk to the business environment, and when midwifery wants to change, it has to address business.
Yeah.
So you get those skills.
Yeah. I think that would be very helpful. Yeah.
And that comes with leadership as well.
To meet them as well. Often it's like unit manager, and that's the end of the line for the midwives working on the ward.
Yeah.
Who they go to. Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, that was one of the good things, and I keep saying this, that the World State of the Midwifery World Report basically says that we need to have midwives at every table of every conversation, that there has to be a midwife there to fly the midwife flag, but also to sit there and go, well, this is actually what it means. This is the real life count, but this is how it can be an advantage.
Yeah, and talk to the managers' priorities and engage. Mm. Yeah.
So did you find the managers wanted a specific type of midwife to work in continuity of care models or caseload models, or were they open to new graduates coming through?
So there was a lot of support to facilitate new graduates and student midwives to work in these models. That's how that cultural change will happen. There was a lot of support for that. And to demystify that whole myth around them not having enough experience or needing more experience after graduation to be able to step into these models, that we should be supporting them to be able to step straight into them. Yeah.
And that preceptorship, I think, is that critical key in that first 3 months, but that first 6 months is the make or break of a career. That if you've got the support in that first 6 months of once you're out, then you will probably survive your career in it.
Yeah, and enjoy it and have that work satisfaction. Yeah.
we're seeing so much internationally at the moment about where the state of midwifery is. And I think this week we had half of a group of nurses in Switzerland kind of walk off in a healthcare system because of conditions. We've had protests in Mexico. We've had the, and a really good news was that in the Netherlands, home birthing is actually recognised as a Dutch culture issue. So they've actually put the importance on home birthing in the Dutch culture is actually now being kind of recognised, and thinking that's just huge. Well, we've still got all these other opposites of struggling kind of workforces and people leaving the workforce and being exhausted, and an ever aging population as well.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got lots of things to address.
We do.
So what else did this couple of suggestions and solutions then came from either the managers or the midwives then? So how do we keep this change happening? Who makes the changes?
So I guess, interestingly, the answer or the theory that I ended up developing came from the interviews with women. So after interviewing a number of midwives, what I started to realise was that there is this huge gap between women and midwives working together, even though we work with women every day in that hospital setting. We just don't develop that real relationship, that true trust and familiarity that we need to. So midwives were actually questioning whether women in the community wanted continuity of care models.
Yep.
So that led me to starting interviews with women. And what the women identified was that in some areas, when the unit was threatening to close and there was going to be no maternity services to support them, they rallied together and they sought key midwives to support them in gaining access to a continuity of care model. And often it was in smaller units where they weren't able to get obstetric support anymore. And the community was like, well, actually, we've heard about this model and you don't need obstetric support. It can be a midwifery-led unit and we can still be cared for in our community. And being able to advocate that to that high-level management and filtering that back down into the unit was really key to those areas implementing models. And the power of the consumer voice came through. And that's what my theory ended up being, is that we need to partner with our women more closely. Mm. We need to work with them and understand what their needs are within our community. And we need to give them a voice and to support them. And we can work together to do that, because as midwives, we know the evidence, or most of us know the evidence. And being able to articulate that to the right people is really important for the women and supports the women to be heard. So that is what that was the main, I guess, theme throughout that, was that that's what we need to do. We need to work with our women more and give them opportunity to give us feedback on what they want.
Have you seen the film Birth Time?
Yes, I have.
And that, because it's just that kind of commonality is kind of reminds me of that brilliant film. But I think almost every single midwife in that film says the same thing, is when women step up and demand change, the system can change overnight.
Yes. You just goosebumps, because it does. But they just, what I found after these interviews were that the way that they are, I'm going to say process, because that's the theme and the code that kept coming through my interviews, the way they're processed through that fragmented system really makes them feel devalued. And how could they feel confident in requesting any sort of change when quite often they felt like they couldn't even make a decision about their own personal care through that system? So that's where we need to come together and support each other and rally together and, build that confidence with each other to make those changes.
It would be it'll never be an ideal world, but I think we're getting closer than what we were, but there's still a long way to go.
Yeah.
But you look at, I mean, long way. And especially when you're looking at the politics, which is what you're addressing, and a lot of it is patriarchal politics. It's looking at election cycle politicians and kind of funding with that. But then you kind of look at, I look at the young, some of the young, and I'm going to say young people because age doesn't really matter. And you look at the Gretas, you look at some of these young people who are kind of standing up and already public figures, and you sit there and kind of go, every generation's had the group of them. And you just, if you can keep the fire going with them, they'll be the ones who lead change and progress. Yeah. And it's how long do you keep banging your head on the table when things don't change before you can pass it on to young people like yourself who are starting in your career that can actually then have the evidence to sit and change and to be able to then invigor other people to do the same thing.
Yeah, I think it's a process of building blocks. Like, I feel like I couldn't have done the research I did if there wasn't the research done prior to what I've done, which is all building on top of what we've done earlier. So,
and we were having kind of a little chat before we kind of started, and there's so many of us that are under the assumption that we're not smart enough to do research.
Yes. I still feel like that.
But you're a dog, you've got the floppy hat, you've got the kind of the piece of paper, you've proven it. But as we're saying, like, your PhD is theoretically your worst research you're ever going to do, and only two people, it's only ever written for two people in that's your markers. Now, you know who your markers were.
Yeah, so my examiners were Jane Sandel, who obviously, I'd read her research because she's set the stone for me to be able to build on top of that and ask these questions that I've been able to ask, and Caroline Homer. So for them to have read my PhD, I think, is probably one of those points in my career where I will never forget getting that letter and seeing their names on that letter to say that I'd been awarded my PhD. It's unbelievable.
Have you framed both the PhD and the letter?
Just my letter.
But that's it. When you sit there and you kind of go, these are the women, like, they're the grand dames of midwifery research. And you look at, Jane is now kind of like the first clinical midwifery of the UK. Carolyn has finally got on as now chair of the NHMRSC, the National Medical and Health Research Council here in Australia. It's like they're at the table. Yeah. They're at the toppest table that you can kind of get speaking for midwifery, and they've brought so many people in their wake behind that in 10 years' time, 20 years' time, people are going to be saying things about you. That's going to be, you're going to have influenced people and students to kind of go through as well.
I don't think I would ever be in their league. They're amazing.
We're all relative.
Lucky to have such amazing, strong role models, I think. Yeah.
And I think that's where we are very political as a discipline, in personal politics, but also state, federal, and international politics. But there's still a lot of people who are lacking faith in what they can do and what they can change.
Yeah.
And the research is showing the proof, showing that this is evidence. This is kind of like what we've done, and we've got so much of it to change practice, but we're still fighting against the smaller groups. We're still fighting against the larger voices.
Yeah, definitely we are. And I think that's stuff we inherit too from our colleagues, definitely. And that lack of confidence, like, we're amazing. We do amazing things when we are allowed to work to our full potential. We just need to realise what we can do and have faith in it and support each other to, I think, work in that way.
I think next year's ICM theme, International Day of the Midwife theme, is the last 100 years and looking at how far we've come. So that's going to be really quite exciting.
That'd be good to go to. I'll have to make sure I get to listen to some of that if it's all opened up again and it goes ahead.
Yeah, well, each state usually has their own kind of different event somewhere in that week, and then you've got their virtual International Day of Midwifery presentations, which is a 24-hour gig, and it's kind of from, it starts, it goes for 24 hours. So we have different presenters from different countries and different facilitators. And basically every hour there's a different presentation that kind of you just click onto. There's an English stream and a Spanish stream, and you click onto it and you'll get anything from Australia, New Zealand, from India, from Middle East, from any of the countries. That kind of goes round, keynotes at the beginning, keynotes at the end. I think the world State of the World Midwifery was launched at the beginning of this year's. So it's definitely worth doing. It's always on the International Day of Midwife.
It's
going for something like 17 years, I think. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. It's so kind of worth tapping in, because you can just, depending on your time zone, and obviously for us being the opposite end to the European time zone, but you still get to hear some fabulous things.
Yeah. Feels like we should organise a party so that we can all watch it together.
Well, you could present. You could put yours in and present as well. And it's like, I think that's where we're getting. Technology is so cool that, as we've seen in the last 2 years or coming up to 2 years, that technology has helped us kind of make the world smaller, even though we've all been in isolation. And I think that thankfully we haven't had to fly places, because it would have been expensive. But the amount of conferences we've attended virtually and the amount of information that's been shared has actually been like 100-fold compared to what it was beforehand.
Yeah, and now it's become part of our work and lives. It's routine now.
Just get the square eyes that don't blink and kind of use the break afterwards. So apart from the midwives being the blocker for changing and not necessarily having the same passion, what else will kind of surprise you from doing your PhD?
I guess that lack of confidence in our skill was a surprise. One of the interviews that I probably will never forget was a CMC I interviewed, and she was worried about transitioning her workforce into a model because the midwives didn't do VEs. And I was like, what? There's midwives that don't do VEs ever? And that blew my mind, and it just made me realise how unconfident I would feel if I had to be expected to work in a new way and didn't have the skill or confidence to be able to do something that's so common, I think, for me to be doing. That was a point in my PhD where I really connected with why midwives would be such a hindrance to implementing a model, and just realizing how inhibited our workforce is working in the model that is predominantly offered to women in Australia. Yeah.
So they're, because of their working in that model and because they don't have as much opportunity to use those skills, their concern is that they're not going to be able to offer the type of service that the woman needs in looking after her.
Yeah, and also being expected to do it and then not feeling comfortable telling people that they can't work their full scope of practice, not being supported to be able to develop those skills, and also being scrutinized by other people if you stepped into that model, and then other people realizing that they don't have that full scope of practice and competence or confidence to do the skills that they need to.
So using VEs as an example, it's not as if it's something like a blood pressure. If you don't get it the first time, somebody else can come in and do it, and it's okay. It's like a VE, it's an invasive procedure. It's an intimate invasive procedure. If you don't get it right, you don't want to go, look, really not sure, need to get somebody else to come in and have a check. Do you mind doing it again?
Yeah,
it's kind of, and I think that's something that a lot of people outside of midwifery don't understand, the intimacy that's involved in midwifery and within our scope of practice that we do, unless they've had a child and then been involved in that whole process. They don't understand that is pressurizing.
Yeah. And the community, I guess, not being aware of, well, obviously they wouldn't know what a midwife's full scope of practice is if we're not practicing our full scope of practice. So how could they be confident that if we're saying to them, hey, this is a new model of care, this is what we're going to offer you, when they've only experienced what they've experienced, which hasn't been midwifery-led care, it's probably been obstetric-led care. That's a huge cultural hurdle to overcome.
So how do we?
Working with women and educating each other and promoting what we do and giving, I think, midwives the opportunity to see how it works, to live in how it works and understand how to manage that way of working. A lot of barriers or thoughts around barriers came up when midwives were, I guess, expressing misinformation around burnout, not being on call 24/7 came up a lot for midwives that I interviewed who'd never worked in a model before, because actually you're not on call 24/7. You often in a caseload have a buddy or two buddies even, and you support each other, and you're not the only person looking after this woman. You've got a support network around you to support that woman, but there's a fear that if we transition into continuity that they'll be on call 24/7 and that there'll be work-related burnout. And there's, you know, that's it. Having children, we're a workforce that have children. How am I going to manage having children and being on call? And there are lots of questions, I think, that we need to answer and get out there to midwives so they can understand what it would look like working in these models. And you can manage it, and actually it can be quite flexible, and it might even suit you more than what a rostered shift work would. Yeah.
So we need those continuity champions to kind of spread the good news.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do we go about upskilling if they're kind of reluctant about upskilling, but then they need to upskill? How do we close those barriers? Because that's a perpetual barrier.
I think you're right there. So another critical aspect or factor that influences being able to achieve implementation is having a project officer or a project lead. And part of their role should be engaging with the workforce, understanding what the skills are that need to be developed so those midwives can feel confident transitioning into those models. And that will depend on where they are and how they work and what the culture is within that service as well. So could be from one extreme of not doing VEs and needing to up-train that skill. But often, and through the literature, I think it's come up a lot that, you know, suturing skills and things like that are often skills midwives identify they'd need if they wanted to work in that way.
And we've already got the precedent. We've already got yearly updates for medication calculations, for basic first aid, for CPR, or CPR more so, and in some places fire management.
Yeah.
Do we need to kind of, and we've got hand hygiene and like there's more and more vaccination stuff now coming, do we need to start adding to that as well so that we do have opportunities to upskill each year on these things that we may not necessarily do every week?
That didn't come out in my interviews as something that would work. But what did come through with my theory development was what's happening in the UK and supporting their workforce over there and all of the learning packages that they've developed for the midwifery workforce to feel confident transitioning into those models. So there's lots of toolkits and things like that that have been developed. So maybe that's something we should be looking at here in Australia, is those resources that midwives can access, I guess, in their own time and be able to develop what it is that they can identify within their own personal scope of practice and give them the opportunity to learn and upskill.
Which fits beautifully in with needing 20 hours of CPD each year, and something that different organisations, AusMed and the ACM and kind of Wound Australia, and those packages that are now more freely available.
Yeah. And all the online learning that we've got access to now.
you can go absolutely bizarre and nuts with it all.
I know. I need like another 24 hours in my day just so I can learn everything I need to.
I almost need to kind of block out one weekend a month and kind of go, you know what, that's just my fun e-learning. Like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got surgery coming up and I'm going to do the Sean's. I'm going to try and sign into Sean's breech birth module and e-learning and kind of sit and do that and kind of sit there. Well, that's a good way to kind of do some recovery while my knee's kind of recovering. I can sit there and do some breech births.
Yeah.
It's not something I get to see as an academic anymore these days.
No, in between marking. That's a good action.
So what did you – you had the advantage of doing it through a scholarship, which means you did it over three and a half years?
So it ended up being four. The last 12 months I did part-time because I picked up full-time work with the university. So that changed that last period. But that ended up being really nice for me, being at that write-up point of my PhD. It just gave me time to sit back and, I guess, take a little bit of a breather and make sure that, you know, I was focused on what I was writing and it was clear and, yeah, so.
So when you're doing it, what pattern did you find worked for you to be able to be productive?
Yep, so I had a baby a year into my PhD and I found she usually woke up about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning for a feed and I would stay up for a few hours in between that feed and the next feed and then getting my oldest daughter ready for school. That was my quarantine time where I would study and I guess that first, I think it was 18 months, my partner lived and worked away during the week. So I only had myself and the girls to look after for that period, which made it a little easier. We ate egg on toast and spaghetti on toast for dinner a lot.
That's fine. That's good. That's fine.
But having that quarantine time every, you know, probably 5 days a week, and it was my job. I made sure that that's what I did, and I just kept chipping away at it, and having that, I guess, that routine really helped me. Just, you know, little bits and pieces. Didn't matter if I sat down and wrote 500 words or 2 words, as long as I kept chipping away at something, it just all comes together. It seems like a big thing when you start, but if you can just chip away at it, you know, regularly, then it will all eventually build into this big document.
Yeah, you can't look at the one document and just say, this is the thesis. It's like, this is part of this chapter of this subheading of this kind of, How did you maintain, if it was just you and the girls then for a lot of the time, how did you maintain that sanity when they got really stroppy or really tired or they just didn't listen to you or you were kind of got to that stage of I really can't do this? Like, did that happen kind of through that process?
I think more, not because of the PhD, it was probably more around life happening around the PhD. Just being tired, we were renovating a house and moved and bought and sold a house and all that. They're pretty big life events. Mm-hmm. Just taking the day off. Like one day every now and again, if you really need to just have the day off, you know, kept the girls at home because I was just tired. I just needed to have a rest and that's okay.
So did that help maintain your mental health?
Yeah, I think so. That's what I did. Or the other thing, I'd go and buy myself something nice.
Yep. Yep. What type of kind of retail therapy did you do?
There was always chocolate, a bottle of wine. Didn't always drink the bottle of wine, but I definitely had a glass.
Yep.
And I really like clothes. Just, you know, a nice piece of clothing. If it was at that time where I was like, I can't do this anymore, I'd have a day off, have some chocolate, a wine with dinner and buy myself something. It wasn't very often, but
that was enough.
It was enough, yeah. I was working hard.
And I think that's it. We leave the rewards to the very end.
Yeah.
Instead of the little milestones or just when we're going to, like, you know what, I've actually done a solid 3 weeks' work. I'm allowed. It's good. I need to recharge. I can go hug a tree. I can go kind of like have an ice cream by the beach and just sit, because you're still thinking. It's still in the back of your mind. And sometimes when you take your mind out of that gear, things actually fall into place a little bit easier when you suddenly come back and look at it.
Yeah, I think so. And stepping away from it sometimes. like you said, go outside, go for a walk, go for a swim at the beach and refresh. Yeah. And often I found, though, if I did, like, go for a walk or something like that, I needed to take a notebook with me. I was trying to have a break. All these thoughts start coming that I hadn't had before, and my notes in my phone, it's full of PhD notes and points that I needed to remember. And I did, in my office, I had butcher's paper on the wall, and it was full of drawings, mind maps, scribble thoughts, don't forget ideas. And even though it was a mess, that was really helpful. Just writing it down and getting it out of my mind and not having to think I needed to remember it.
A lot of people have said that their phone and the recording, they'd go take the dog for a walk and then they'd just be sitting there talking into their phone as these things were just, and almost like free thought. It's just kind of like, we're just going blah, 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 and then they kind of back, and they listened to it back 2 weeks ago and went, that's crap. Oh, wait, no. That's what I meant now. Now I understand.
Yeah. And the shower.
Yes.
Get me all the time.
See, I think that's what somebody needs to invent, and I'm sure that there is somewhere, if we looked hard enough, there'd be something available online, probably through Amazon, where there is a voice recorder that you can stick on the wall in the shower. That just kind of like is automatically voice recorded, so you can just sit and talk to it and it will automatically transcribe it and send it to the cloud to your notes and things like that. So
I wonder if like Google Home or Google Nest could do something like that.
Well, if it's within voice reach, why not?
I wish I had that actually while I was doing my PhD. We've only just bought one and you just made me think of that. That would have been perfect.
There you go. So using kind of Siri or Google or one of the overlords, as I call them, you have to be nice to them because they will kind of Skynet Israel. that it'll be just like, Siri, could you please take a note? And kind of like talking about, it'd be interesting to see if you had a conversation what they would come back with.
Yeah.
But then again, they've had AI.
Described it with.
As discussed with Siri on the 24th of the thing. But they had, I think this week, they tried to do something with AI and it never works. It always goes very, very, very wrong to do some health conversations. And it started up with health diagnosis and health conversations. And I think within a day or so, it then ended up talking about genocide.
Oh, no.
So I think AI could be interesting to a degree, at least get you thinking about other things, but... Yeah, need voice activated recording or conversation in the shower.
Yeah, yeah.
It goes straight to your computer then and then you kind of make sense of it.
Yeah, and just dot points it and then puts it straight into your PhD document.
Yeah. You know what? In 10 years' time, it could possibly do that.
Probably. We probably won't have to type our PhDs anymore.
Just think it.
Yeah.
We could just think it and, oh, that would be scary.
That would be scary.
You'd have to then do some really proper editing to make sure.
Yeah.
Strange thoughts go out there. So what did you do to celebrate then?
So not too much because it was like COVID when I found out that I had been awarded my PhD. I went out for dinner with my parents and my sisters and my primary PhD supervisor. So he was local here to Port Macquarie.
Yep.
That wasn't too much. Just
so now that you're opening up, it's a year later, how are you going to have your second celebration?
I haven't graduated yet, so February next year. Yeah. Graduation, I get to wear the floppy hat.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you get to have a second celebration.
Yeah, we'll have to book somewhere and celebrate.
Do something fun.
Yeah. We were going to go overseas. That was our plan, but that was never going to happen.
Well, borders are opening. Places are now more available, and from next April it will definitely be more available than what is now. Just depends on where you want to go.
Yeah. Don't know now. We were planning Thailand, but I'm not sure.
I think they'd be happy.
They'd be happy to have me?
They'd be happy to have kind of like visitors, I think. I think any country that kind of does relies on tourism would be happy to have.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe somewhere in Australia now. Now that everybody else is. And I get all these posts on Instagram and Facebook of all the beautiful places in Australia.
I think that's one thing, having travelled to a few countries and around East and Western Europe in my youth, and travelled a little bit around some of the places in Australia, we have some absolutely gorgeous sites to kind of go that you could endlessly travel around and see something new and meet new people. And it just depends on whether you want. We have everything. We go from desert to rainforest. Like, do you want to be hot? Do you want to be cold? Do you want to be dry? Do you want to be humid? Do you want to kind of like watch the sky dance at night down in Tasmania? Do you kind of want to sit and watch crocodiles sunbaking in kind of like, we have such a bizarre opportunity in this country to see such a range of things.
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
We just have to work. We have
beautiful beaches.
We do indeed. We do indeed. So if people were kind of thinking, so you're going to have students now, you're going to teach students now, you're going to be now in the situation where you're going to be secondary supervisor very soon and then coming up to primary supervisor, you're going to have honour students coming up to you. What advice are you going to give them that you've learned that changed the way that you did your PhD?
I definitely would encourage them to pick a topic that they're passionate about. I love my PhD. I still love my topic, and I think that's because I chose it because I was so passionate about it. What else? I guess taking from my primary supervisor and the style of his supervision, knowing that, like, he let me take the lead. It was my research, and he was very patient with me, and I really needed that given the stage of life that I was at, doing a PhD and having a baby halfway through a PhD. I didn't need someone pressuring me to have a meeting every 2 weeks. It just wouldn't have worked for me. I think being flexible around that and understanding your capabilities and what works for you. Don't try and fit into someone else's mold of what worked for them. Make sure you know what works for you, and quarantine that for yourself and protect it. That's what helped me get through my PhD. So definitely that would be my advice. Yeah.
What did you learn about yourself?
How much I value relationships with people, actually.
Okay.
I think that came through with some of, because constructivist grounded theory is about recognizing your contribution to the way data is analyzed and the theory that gets developed. When I sat back after I wrote my PhD, I realized how much I value the people in my life and how much I value that connection with people. And I think that came out in my PhD. And I'm really proud of that. And the people I met through all these interviews, I would never have had the opportunity to interview the people that I was able to interview. And that's something that I really cherish from this experience. Yeah.
So how are you feeding back the results of your PhD to those participants?
So I've worked a little bit with some of my participants in disseminating some of that information just through conferences and opportunity to do virtual like meetings and things like that. I'm part of a few different research projects now looking at models that have been implemented, particularly up here on the Mid-North Coast. And that's been a way of, using some of the findings that I found in my own research and helping to, overcome some of the challenges and recognising some of the barriers that might come up and what might help to overcome them. So there are a few different ways that I've tried, or I have been given the opportunity to influence or use the findings that I found, and working on my publications. So very close to getting one submitted now, and that's probably my next goal, is just getting it out there, getting that information out there that way.
Which leads perfectly to what next?
What next?
Where do you want your passion to now drive you?
Well, I love research, and I love that it can help change practice. So I have started putting together and submitting grant applications to support my theory, which was to build communities of practice and bringing women and midwives together to work towards providing feedback and developing services that are continually meeting the needs of the community and what it is that women in their local community and what they want, giving them a voice. So that's something that I think I'll always be passionate about, and that's something that I'm already trying to start working towards. But, yeah, I love my job at the uni. I love teaching the students. That's something I find really rewarding, and being a midwife, jumping back into the clinical side of things and picking up shifts when I can and being with women and babies.
Well, when you're with the women, you're changing one life at a time. When you're with research, you're changing potentially generational lives at a time. So you've got both covered.
That's a nice way to think of it.
So thank you so much for
giving
me your time.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for, it was a good conversation.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.